And all the checks are in the boxes. And the clowns have all gone to bed. You can hear happiness staggering on down the street. Footprints dressed in red. And the wind whispers fairy.
These days, the top rock bands travel with a crew of nearly 150 people with daily production costs totaling $750,000. It's hard to imagine a time when superstars like Jimi Hendrix, who we're listening to, Chuck Berry, The Animals, Ike and Tina Turner, traveled in cars and buses to their concerts. Riding shotgun for them was James Tappy Wright, who was a first-hand witness to some of rock's most legendary performances and greatest tragedies. In his memoir, Rock Roadie, Backstage and Confidential with Hendrix, Elvis, The Animals, Tina Turner, and an all-star cast, Tappy Wright recalls his decades spent on the road with some of rock's founding fathers. It's written with Rod Weinberg and published by St. Martin's Press and brings James Tappy Wright to our show today. Hello.
Good morning.
What do you make of the rock show as spectacle, as evidenced by U2's 360-degrees tour or somebody like Lady Gaga, if she can be considered a rock singer? I mean, they're wearing outfits by Giorgio Armani.
well, you know, I have to kind of take it with a pinch of salt, because in my day, you know, there was me, there was the instruments and the group, all in one vehicle. Whereas now, you know, you've got 50 trucks, helicopters, personal trainers, personal chefs. It's not rock and roll. And the worst part about it now is most of the artists that you see on the stage, they lip sync. And this I can't stand. I like to go and see an artist sing. I don't want to see them dancing. I want to hear them sing. And it annoys me immensely.
Well, perhaps that's the influence of all of the music videos. We've come to expect something quite different. But it is lucrative. The most recent tour by the Rolling Stones grossed $558 million.
Well, good on them, you know. Yeah. Good on them. These guys, they're my age, and they're still doing it. And they were good guys. Nice. Mick Jagger was a beautiful guy, really nice. You know, there was nothing airs and grace about him. Good for the Rolling Stones, good for the industry.
Do you really think we need that many people to put something together? I assume that when you were in the early days, you were putting the drum kit together, making sure all the amplifiers were plugged in and in the right place.
Well, that's right. I was a musician myself, although not the best. I always feel my definition of a roadie is a failed musician. But the fact is, we knew all about the instruments, so I could go on the stage while these guys were in the dressing room, and I could set up the back line, I could set the drums up and the organ. I knew exactly what to do. So, yeah, you know, I did it all.
When you were growing up in the north of England in the late 50s and early 60s, was starting a rock band, was it called rock and roll then, I assume?
No. What
I mean, it was Cliff Richards in England. It wasn't really very serious music, was it?
No, well, Cliff Richard kind of copied the Elvis or the Bobby Rydells and all that. He was one of your early, he was a good-looking boy, you know. But when I first started to play, I mean, you couldn't buy American guitars. You had to buy German Hofners or something. And, you know, there was no drum kits. We used washboards. So it was kind of a Rock Island Line skiffle band, how we all started way back in the early 50s. Then we progressed to a drum kit. So, you know, we went through the whole learning process.
How did you get your start as a road manager?
What happened was I was in a group called the Wildcats, playing cover versions, all American hits by Chuck Berry and Elvis and them sort of things. This other band, the Animals, they came along to watch us play one night, and they stole our guitar player, Hilton Valentine. So Eric Burden came over and says, "Look, I'm sorry about that, but I can't give you a job as a musician, but would you fancy the idea of being our roadie, since you know all about instruments?" So I jumped at the chance, and I became the Animals' road manager.
And you toured with them in America.
I did.
Was the music scene very different here? Was the response of kids at a performance very different than it was in the UK?
Yeah, they were more kind of more enthusiastic in the United States. The kids, you know, when we first, well, you've probably seen all documentary news footage. When we used to land at JFK, there were thousands of girls, groupies, all just on looking over the where we get off the plane. And when we got to the hotel, there were thousands outside the hotel. We didn't have this in England. You see, it was a big culture shock for us.
And mostly, like, the animals were singing American songs, like The House of the Rising Sun.
Yeah, it's an old traditional folk song, you know, and that we did on a tour with Chuck Berry, and we decided, Eric said, let's record it for an album, because it was 5 minutes long. Nobody ever thought for 1 minute it would get released as a single, but EMI in England said, no, we want it as a single, so there you go. And we recorded that in one take, and that cost us $3.75 to make that record. Do you want to believe that? One take, $3, and it was number one worldwide.
Well, what do you think a group like? How do you think a group like the Animals would do today, or another group that you were with, which was a bit more British, Herman's Hermits? They do sound a bit dated, don't they?
Oh, they do now. Yeah, it's 40-odd year ago. But Peter Noon and Herman's Hermits, he was a lovely guy. But he I think he was kind of your first toy boy band, wasn't he? Because he was very pretty. Mm-hmm. The mothers loved him, the daughters loved him, the grandmothers loved him. And he sold a lot of records. He outsold the Beatles and everybody on 1965 with all them little dated songs, I'm Henry VIII and stuff like that, you know. Dreadful songs, but it made him a lot of money.
It sounded very much like British Music Hall, didn't it? My old man said, follow the van.
Yeah, that's it. It was very much based on that. Yes, you're dead right.
When did drugs become a major problem?
Kind of the mid-60s. In the early 60s, there wasn't much of it about. I remember the first time I ever seen any drugs was marijuana, and I was like even frightened to touch it because I used to watch all them American movies that when you heard the name drugs, it went do 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 do, and it was scary. But in the mid 60s, well, LSD came into it in a big way. It's the only good thing about LSD. The Beatles wrote some wonderful songs while they were on it. But apart from that, no, I never took drugs. I stayed straight all the way.
Because you saw what the effect it was having on other people?
Well, not so much that. It was you know, my job. As the boys were getting bigger, I kind of, you know, I had to get out of bed 3 hours before them to get them out of bed, to make sure they got in the shower, to make sure they either got on the bus or either got on the plane. It was hard work for me because it was only me. I remember eventually I got an assistant, and boy, did that feel great.
I'm assuming you also had to sober them up in some cases. How much of an effect did the drugs have on the performances of the bands that you worked with?
Well, I don't think it had. I think in some cases, and I dread to say it, in some cases it enhanced their performance. But then there was other times, you know, especially with Jimmy, where he just fell flat on his backside and he just couldn't perform.
Well, it was very damaging. Any number of people died. I knew Janis Joplin. Yeah. And although she died of a drug overdose, I wouldn't have described her as the heaviest drug user in her band at the time.
Well, I remember I was at Woodstock with Janis and all them, and I remember the in the backstage there was like a water fountain there, and somebody, I don't know who it was, had put loads of LSD into the water thing. So people, when they were drinking the water, didn't realize they were getting higher and higher on LSD.
My guest is James Tappy Wright, who's written with the help of Rod Weinberg, Rock Roadie, Backstage and Confidential with Hendrix, Elvis, The Animals, Tina Turner, and an all-star cast. It's published by St. Martin's Press and the Thomas Dunn Books imprint. And you were at Monterey with Jimi Hendrix, who interestingly made his reputation in England before he ever came to the United States.
That's right. You see, the Animals broke up in the summer of 66. They couldn't get on. They were fighting each other. So everybody had different agendas. And Chas Chandler wanted to manage an artist. So we were told by this young lady, who was Keith Richards' girlfriend, she was called Linda Keith, to go down to the Café War in the Village, which we did. And we saw this guy. He was okay. He wasn't special. But then all of a sudden, the guy started playing with his teeth behind his head, under his legs. And Chas went, oh, boy, I think I can do something with this guy. And that was the birth of Jimi Hendrix.
And they brought him to England and became a star there, not here. He, at that time, was he still being called Jimmy James?
We changed it to Jimi Hendrix right after the Café War. And we changed the Jimmy from double M-Y to single M and an I. He went to England, and when Jimmy first went, he wasn't taking drugs and stuff like that in the beginning. He was so excited that he was going to be a star, and he did his best work, I think, in England with Hey Joe, Foxy Lady, Purple Haze. All that early stuff was fantastic. And I got a call one day from, it was Paul McCartney, talking about this festival we were going to do in Monterey, California. He wanted the Animals. And we said, well, look, you know, can we put our other artist on there, Jimi Hendrix? He's doing very well in England. Of course, Paul McCartney knew of him. And he said, absolutely. So that was Jimmy's first big performance in the USA.
Do you think he was destroyed by his fame?
Yes. In the end, yes.
I know there are all sorts of discrepancy about the details surrounding his death, but you make a rather startling claim in your book, and you've kept it secret for 30 years?
Well, yes, because I just kind of just walked away with it because it was, at the time, was too dangerous to discuss it because, you know, I would have been in the obituary column too had I disclosed all what I knew all them years ago. It was only when I got older and I thought, you know, the truth should come out. It's not just to sell books. It's to set the record totally straight as to how Jimmy died. And Jimmy was murdered.
Really?
Absolutely. And, you know, without going too long into the story, his manager, Mike Jeffries, who used to manage the Animals, was at the end of his contract with Jimmy. Jimmy was going to leave him. Mike Jeffries was in such debt with the IRS. He had to pay them $30,000 a month. He had to borrow money from the mob to pay his debts off, and Jimmy refused to work. At the end of the day, Mike Jeffries had a $2 million insurance out on him. He was a beneficiary. And in his eyes, the way he talked to me, I was his longest-serving employee, so I knew him very well. And he said, you know, Tappy, it was either kill or be killed, because he felt if Jimmy had walked away from him, he would have been killed because he owed the wrong people money.
Do you think go ahead.
And I have to say, you know, there's going to be people who think, nah, that's not true. But the Times of London did this huge investigated piece of journalism, and they went to Australia and they found the doctor who was in the hospital at the time Jimmy was taken in there. He said he was already dead, but he said whoever wrote that book is actually telling the whole truth, because that's exactly how Jimi Hendrix died. It wasn't the drugs and the vomit inhalation. He drowned, and he was drowned by red wine, and they poured it like waterboarding, but they went straight into his windpipe. Mike Jeffries was a special ex-SAS guy. He knew all about killing and how to kill, so that's exactly how he died. And the doctor backs me up and confirms it. And even everybody that was in our in business, they all knew it was true, but, you know, they couldn't put two and two together.
Well, there are any number of unpleasant people in the business in those days. Was Tina Turner, was Ike Turner as nasty as he's been portrayed in the movies?
Well, in that day he was, yes. I felt so sorry for, because I was with Ike and Tina when all this was, right at the height when all this was going on, you see, and I used to pick Tina up, and She always had sunglasses. She used to say to me, come in the morning, please, take me away. So we'd go to the stores or we'd go to markets, outdoor markets, anything to get away from Ike. She was terrified of him. Mm. And she used to say, you know, some of the things that he used to do. And I was scared of him too. He pulled a knife on me once because I did a wrong turning. And I opened the window and all the air came in and blew his hair out of position. And he wasn't happy.
Well, we have very little time left, but I do want to talk about Elvis for just a moment. You spent an afternoon with him at Graceland. And at that point, he was already kind of in decline, wasn't he? Did he feel that his time had passed?
Yeah, sort of. He was doing all these movies. And in fact, I was with Peter Noon when I first met him. It's quite funny. But I just flew into Hawaii. It was very... we were very tired. I said, no phone calls. We're so tired. And I got into the bed, and then the phone rang, and I heard, oh, hi, this is Elvis Presley. And I kind of told him to go forth and multiply. So I went downstairs, complained to the girl, and she says...
It really was Elvis.
It was Elvis. So I rang him up, apologized. He said, look, don't worry about it. I can't even order a pizza.
They think that he was joking. Look, we've run out of time, unfortunately. We couldn't get to Little Richard and some of the other people fascinating people you've known. James Tappy Wright, written with Rod Weinberg, the book Rock Roadie, Backstage and Confidential with Hendrix, Elvis, The Animals, Tina Turner, and an all-star cast. It's published by St. Martin's Press and the Thomas Dunn Books imprint. Thanks again, Tappy.
It's my pleasure. Good interview. Thank you.
I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Understood.